Hello, I'm Hal Lublin.
And I'm Mark Gagliardi.
Since the dawn of humanity, one issue has gone unsettled. With the fate of the world in the balance, we're here to settle once and for all. Best Mission Impossible film.
That's right. Don't worry, everyone. We got this.
Podcasts should have a theme song.
Podcasts should not have a theme song.
Yes, they should.
No, they shouldn't.
They sound good.
Yeah, but people are just going to skip past it.
You know what?
You're right. We got this.
Mr. Lublin, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to decide which of the Mission Impossible films ranks number one. As always, you may assemble your team as required, and this message will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
Okay. Oh, jeez. 5 seconds.
All right, Mission Impossible 2. That was a fun podcast. Nice to see you guys.
Wait, no. Hey, Matt. Matthew.
Oh, sorry.
James. Ignacio Arnold. You and Frank Wall.
Are you using all of them?
Yeah, got them all. Even the ones that I told anybody about.
Yeah, I know all the secret names. This is the IMF. This is what we do. You and Freddie Wong, of course, from Story Break, our fellow Maximum Fun podcast, are joining us.
What is up, Max Fun?
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello, crossover. It all happened because of Twitter.
All because of Twitter. This is a crazy story for us being on here. Can I tell it? Can I tell why
Please,
we're here?
Please, tell the meet cute. Do it.
So, yeah.
I don't even know why we're on here, so this is good. So, I had to hear this.
Matt and I have a reputation amongst our friends of being loud arguers, and we see argumentation and rhetoric as the ancient Romans did, as a sport, as a way to show one's character. And we don't ever take it personally, but it is strong enough that we've gotten in college. We would do this. We would get into an argument. One of the more famous ones was, is cheesecake a pie or a cake? It was so powerful that we had friends come up to us afterwards and be like, are you guys still okay? Are you guys still friends? Like, they thought that we were like really actually mad at each other. But for us, we know that in the safe space of argumentation and debate is the crucible of friendship can be formed.
Amen.
Yes.
Yes.
So we did an experimental thing for another podcast that we do called Dungeons and Daddies, where we made a little mini podcast called Debate Me Coward. And the point was to try and give our fans sort of the idea of what this argumentation is like and what Will, our other co-host on Story Break, has to go through being a friend with us on a week-by-week basis. And
he doesn't like arguing. It's like the poor guy's just stuck in between the two of us yelling at each other all the time.
So we had people come up to us on the Twitter, and there was like, are you familiar with We Got This? Because this is like kind of their steez, and you guys would be great on it. So just out of nowhere on Twitter, I was like, all right, let's go. We would love to be on. And then it was like, oh yeah, also another Maximum podcast. Oh, perfect. And then some Zoom meeting invites got sent, and here we are.
Yeah, I love it. That whole thing does, though, feel like a warning that you're like, guys, there's going to be blood.
I think what's good
and if
about
it's
this
John
one,
Woo, there's going to be slow-mo blood.
Be a lot of blood. We're passionate people, and we got a lot of passion for this series.
And we hear that you folks are passionate people as well. And you know what? It's hard to find a good group of like-minded, passionate people to hash out the hard topics.
Exactly.
That's right.
We find the objective answers to the subjective questions.
Nowhere else on the internet will you find four men passionate about movies.
I know, right?
Talking about movies.
Never.
Podcast.
I didn't find it, but here we are.
You know what? That's a good point. For our listeners, movies are, they have these places called theaters. You can go see them. They put the picture up on the screen.
They did.
People aren't talking about it. Not anywhere. And by the way, just to talk about the heated debate and rhetoric, Mark and I once reached an impasse at an episode. And we edited out the part where it was like, well, neither of us are budging. This is going to be a 5-hour episode. And it got to the point where we ended an episode, and then his girlfriend at the time started trash talking me over text afterwards because she disagreed. Then we argued about it again.
Perfect.
And eventually went on Judge John Hodgman to have him settle it.
Oh, no. Who won?
Yeah.
I did.
Did. Am I pointing in the correct direction for Hal?
You're pointing at Freddy on my screen.
Yeah. Hey, congratulations, Freddy.
Good job, Freddy.
We're on Zoom right now. So this is one of the rare occasions where we do get to see everyone that is on the show today.
Yeah,
which is nice.
Because normally when I do a podcast, I avert my eyes. I'm just like, don't look at me right now. It's just me and my...
You're the Sia of podcasting.
Yeah, exactly. The hair all the way down.
Yeah, blind, right down in your face.
Like a horse.
But we're not here to talk about Sia. We are here to talk about the Mission Impossible films. Who asked this one, Hal?
This is Kristen Kelly, who seems to know you. We get a lot of messages from Kristen Kelly just to give you guys some background. That's like, ask Mark about the time he was naked at Times Square and it was New Year's Eve. And I'll ask Mark and he'll be like, yeah, that happened. I don't like.
That's a story.
Yeah. She knows a lot about you. She may be behind you right now.
Is she standing behind me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kristen Kelly, are you behind me right now? Yeah. You guys, wait a minute. We're on Zoom right now doing this. None of you could warn me if anybody is creeping up behind any of the three of you, I'll warn you.
But it's
just so
show.
You know.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. I can't believe you wouldn't do that for me, Hal.
This might be a big fake background behind me. You never know.
Yeah.
If I see two people just wheeling it away
frame. You know what? Okay. That is a good visual gimmick that I haven't seen yet, which is the background's there. And then you green screen, you just literally have the clone of yourself like wheeling it away. Zoom background jokes happened for, it was like 30 hot internet seconds. And it was like, everyone's like, we got it. It's dumb.
If I was Freddy, what I would do is my Zoom background would just be a plate of my room clean. Like literally the same, literally, like not like a fancy, not like a.
you're gonna do me like that, huh?
Well, look, I appreciate that you just threw the blanket over it. You know who didn't do that? Charlie Puth in that huge mega concert. Did you guys watch that big mega concert that was like all the stars from home? It was like a whole day long thing and they raised a ton of money, but Charlie Puth was one of them. And dude did not make his bed.
Okay,
was singing on, I can't tell if that is a super lazy move or if that is the most baller move
most
you can do.
Powerful move.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I'm going to be on, like it was on every channel. And he's like, I'm not going to make my bed.
And I could change. Yeah.
Yeah.
Welcome to my room. This is who I am.
I think it was a power move because he ended it by staring directly into his camera for 45 seconds while urinating. That's your marking territory at that point.
You could hear it. It was weird.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was loud.
Let's talk about Mission Impossible movies.
Yes.
I propose an idea to you for a way to break this down.
All right.
Because going movie by movie, it might get repetitious because these movies – having recently watched them in the last few days, they all have so many things in common.
Yeah.
And there are more categories we could create, but I've broken them down into a bunch of categories. So I propose, as we often do on this show, is we go with each of the categories, find a winner in each of those categories, and then our ultimate victor will start to emerge.
Okay, so I see that you have a category on year. Personally, 2011 was a really good year for me.
Look.
Ghost Protocol, I think, wins that one. I don't know about any of you guys.
I mean, it was a good year. It was really good.
Yeah,
did we figure it out already? Are we done? Yeah.
That's it. 2011. It's Ghost Protocol.
I have a 2015 Macquarie in the cellar that I'm just waiting to pop open.
All right. So if I may, just to get us a general, I think one good one to start with, the directors.
Yeah, I think this is a good place to start.
We've got the original Mission Impossible directed by Brian De Palma, Mission Impossible 2 directed by John Woo, Mission Impossible 3 directed by J.J. Abrams, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol directed by Brad Bird, and the last two, Rogue Nation and Fallout, directed by Christopher McQuarrie. Thoughts off the bat.
Can I just point out that when the original Mission Impossible film came out in, was it 95?
96.
96. That was at a time when a lot of television from the 60s and 70s was being adapted into motion pictures. Mm-hmm. Brady Bunch was made around them. Adam's Family had already had a sequel at that point. And De Palma seemed like the right guy to direct it because his movies are paranoia based. Mm-hmm. So this idea of conspiracy theory and government stuff, that movie is a bogged down mess.
It's a wild movie. I'll say of all the movies, that's the one that would not be made to Dan. Like, whatever you want to say about Woo's, like, John Woo's movie is definitely still in the vein of the Fast and the Furious, like the kind of over-the-top pulpy action. Whereas Brian De Palma, like, when was the last time you've seen a big blockbuster movie with that much weird auteur independent filmmaking? Like, it's a bonkers movie going back and rewatching it.
Well, he was the last of the four film school buddies to do a giant blockbuster like this. So, you know, you had Coppola, Lucas, Spielberg, and De Palma, and he was the last of that class
that
got to put his stamp on a thing. I actually really liked it.
Yeah, in a weird way, it's ends up being the most unique out of all of them. Because I think when you look back at them, and I think it's especially true of the Ghost Protocol and onwards from 2011 on, they have the Bourne Identity problem, where it's like, which one is that? Is that the one where he climbs the thing? Or is that the one where he's on the
right?
Or which is it? Like, they start to blend a little bit, but like, you cannot mistake both Tom Cruise's hair in Mission Impossible 2 and also De Palma's direction in this Mission Impossible 1.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yep.
He does a great job with it. And what he also does is set up all of the things that are coming. You know what I mean? Like, there are so many things that become tropes through these movies, and we'll get to those. But he, you know, he's George Washington. He's the president that set the precedent for all of the stuff to come.
Oh, talk about, by the way, Ving Rhames, like, just dunking from half court. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, Luther.
I get it. I get it. Tom Cruise is going to be Ethan Hunt, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's been a Rhames party for...
they can't get rid of him.
They can't get rid of him. It's been 24 years of Rhames.
Yeah. And there was one movie that he wasn't in until one cameo at the end, and it was like, boo, where was he the whole time?
That's got to go down with, like, I'm reminded by, who was it? I have to look this up. There was the other rapper who was going, it was not Ludacris. It was going to be the guy in Fast and Furious.
I don't know.
Ludacris is in it, right?
Yeah. So Ludacris
was Busta? Was it Busta Rhymes?
Yes. Busta Rhymes was asked originally, and I believe he turned it down, and it was like,
bad decision.
Ludacris. That's like live on that. Let's live on royalties forever money. You know what I mean? Like, that's it. That's your done. Let me say amongst the directors really quick. Now, Matt and I are probably the biggest Woo fans. I would say off the top right away, Woo and Abrams, I think, are at the bottom of this list in terms of the right time and the right material for the director. I think Abrams specifically.
I'm trying to take the knife out of my heart when I just heard Freddie say Woo is at the bottom of this list.
Well, no, because I would say this, because I would say that, like, for example, like, this is right around the era of the greatest Woo stuff, especially.
Yeah.
This is
Face Off had already come out.
It's a lesser Face Off for sure in terms of, like,
Woo. It's tough to compare that when you look at it's the Mona Lisa right next to some, like, drawing of an ornithopter. You know, right? It's Leonardo still, but one was a sketch and the other one is hanging in the loop. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Abrams and Matt and I were talking about this earlier. When you watch that one, it's three, especially watching it now, when you look at the direction, it's so, the action especially is shot so tight and it feels like you're watching TV, because this is Abrams in his transitional time period, coming from the world of Alias, coming from the world of television and becoming and developing into, you know, this big cinematic.
Yeah.
But I think he's definitely still in the middle of a transition.
But I loved that. J.J. Abrams was one of my favorite directors of these, because to me he felt like an outlier in it. Probably because he had come from television and everything's close and everything is like, John Woo did insane. Like, there's not much story or character. It's a music video with 15 minutes. But what J.J. Abrams did that I thought was cool and sort of outside of the series is that everything was character based. It was all like, you really, really care about the people, and like his tech in that, all of the tech that he chooses, or I don't know how much of this was the screenplay and how much of this was the, like, a general idea for the thing. But like, there's not some sort of projector or 3D mapping on a table. He gets out a Sharpie and draws on the window the outline. You know what I mean? It was just the climax of the movie is CPR. Like, I loved how organic his movie was. Yeah.
So it felt reactionary, I think, frankly, to.
Yes.
Like, it was a reaction to John Woo's insanity.
John Woo's. Well,
the only thing it carries over from the first two films is Ethan Hunt and Luther. Things that everything else, you could assume that Ethan Hunt is this legendary IMF agent who's now behind a desk, that he's not really doing that work anymore. Mm-hmm. You didn't need the first two films. They could just be like 5 minutes of that story. Its job is to reset what the entire franchise is. And then Mad Robot, I think, produced everything after that. So he had some hand in it somewhere and set the table for the following three films.
Mm-hmm.
I
definitely feel like the first, because we can get into, like, for me, honestly, like, probably my personal favorite movies on my two, but that's not the best. I think probably my vote for best, or at least the director's best forward, is Brad Bird. But I think what's interesting is the first three movies, each of the directors brings something that becomes necessary for the rest of the series. And Ghost Protocol feels like the kind of the fruition of everything. Cause like, so the first one sets up, right? It's Mission Impossible. Like,
right.
You got Tom Cruise, you got the kind of the paranoia, you got the masks, you got all that stuff.
Right.
And John Woo's definitely the one who brings in the, okay, we're going to put a knife next to his eye. Tom Cruise is going to climb a rock.
But he also did bring in some, like, he brought in martial arts and rock climbing, which weirdly, I mean, they play in huge for the rest of the series.
Yeah. And then J.J. Abrams from, you know, Alias and Lost and everything.
By the way. And the motorcycles,
yeah.
Oh, but he definitely brings, like, this is going to be, like, Bond, but even bigger kind of thing. It's kind of what John Woo brings. And then Abrams comes in and is like, okay, we're bringing in his family and I'm going to make the team feel tighter and actually more like a TV show. Like, it's going to be fun. Like, you're going to care about the team and him. And then when you get Ghost Protocol, all those things come together. It's like, okay, we're big spy stuff again. We're doing the biggest stunts ever. And we're going to bring in Jeremy Renner and, you know, story about his wife. And we're going to kind of bring in all the stuff that JJ brought to it too. So it does feel like those first three movies are kind of figuring it out, and then Ghost Protocol is like, all right, here's big franchise Mission Impossible now.
Yeah,
and Bird found some funny too.
Yes. Oh yeah, he brings the humor into the cartoon.
And I think, by the way, in terms of him coming from the animation background, gives those movies and the action sequences there such a dynamic precision that you rarely get in live action.
Like, it looks like the whole thing was storyboarded.
Yeah, yes. and it's beautiful. And it's because whereas, like, I would say, like, Woo's action it's an impressionistic painting, right? It's flashes of slow motion. It's, you know, flame. It's all this sort of stuff kind of blowing past camera. It's impressionistic. Mm-hmm. Whereas Bird has this sort of precision, which you rarely get to see in live action. And it's always the case when these animation guys transition to live action. And a lot of the times, a lot of the reason why I think a lot of them, when you talk to them, you see or read their interviews, they don't really like live action because they frankly don't have as much control as they do compared to animation. It's always a little bit of a learning process for them. And I think Bird has this sort of like chef-like ability to pull in all the stuff from the previous ones and cohese them together and sort of bring them in a way that then sets the tone for McQuarrie to kind of go from afterwards. And I love McQuarrie as a director, but I would also argue that, frankly, from 2015 on, McQuarrie's involvement with these movies, you might as well put a slash Tom Cruise in there as well, because that's how much Tom Cruise is also saying, hey, I want to do X, Y, and Z. When you listen to...
We're going to space now, right? It's like the next one. He's like, we're going to space.
I want to hang off of the Airbus, right? Like, that's Tom Cruise making that call as producer, actor, extraordinaire.
Right.
And kind of calling the shot in that way. So, you know, and I think McQuarrie is great at being able to roll with those punches, but he's rolling with Tom Cruise at that point. Whereas Bird almost is like the last one of them to really be able to set that.
What a great list of directors, by the way.
Oh,
I mean,
I'm fans of all of them and they all bring something to it. And I think that's definitely the high point of the series, which makes me, again, I love McQuarrie, but there's something I liked about Tom Cruise's original, like, idea for the series of, like, a new director coming in and giving it its style. Mm-hmm. Like, you're definitely going to lose that now because McQuarrie did two and he's going to do, like, the next two, which is fine. But there's something like, you know, I kind of wish that you would have, like, you know, whatever, Christopher Nolan do one and whatever, like, everybody brings their own style to it, but, you know, it is what it is. Obviously, he found his partner.
It's interesting because it started out and it started going in the direction of being more James Bond, where they do have especially different directors coming in. Sam Mendes did his run, so everything has a unique feel to it. And they sort of ditched that at three and said, we're going to make this a long story. So it definitely feels more episodic, especially watching the back-to-back, which is something Mark pointed out to me. But I also think as a series, I forget that I watched all of them in the theater. I enjoyed all of them, but their batting average is extraordinarily high. I like four of them a lot. The two I don't like as much, I still think are pretty good.
They're still fun. It's still great use of John Woo.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I would say also one of the things that I appreciate with Mission Impossible over that is that, like, even the current Slay the Bond movies, if you had just some rando, right, layperson watch them, they would be hard pressed to be like, oh, this is this director's style at the end of watching, right? It's hard to pull Mendes' style out from the Bond aesthetic. Whereas Mission Impossible wears the director's influence on its sleeve in a way that is very, it feels very unique, because I think as time has gone on, as more money gets thrown into these blockbusters, stuff just amalgamates, right? Like, at a certain point, children's animation, it's like, yeah, there's flair and there's great directors there, but for the average layperson, it all is a certain level of polish at a certain point, you know? And that's kind of what I always liked about that sort of initial, that run, just as a series, Mission Impossible, because you were able to get this flavor that just frankly does not exist in any large scale action franchise anymore.
Not just large scale, the largest scale.
Yeah.
It's like having a workshop theater, but with a $1 billion budget.
Yeah.
So they get to do a lot of fun stuff. So what do we think coming out of this first category? You kind of sold me on Brad Bird.
Yeah, if I was going to be like, I think it's kind of like, what's your taste? Like, to me personally, I think the version that Brad Bird does is my favorite tone of Mission Impossible. Like, I think he's not obviously as like, he's not comedic per se, but like, I like that everything's breaking. I like that the tools don't work. I like the kind of and frankly, just the whole Dubai sequence to me is just the best directed sequence of all.
It's pretty incredible.
It's like that 45 minutes of just nonstop intercutting and the stunts, like, it's one of the biggest stunts he does, but there's just as much direction with Simon Pegg and the humor going on in the small room as like he's outside on the building. Like, I like, the movie's a little long to me, and like the back half isn't as good as like the front half. Like, for me, like, you can't beat the Dubai sequence, but man, I just love Brad Bird's style. Like, he's probably my favorite director for Mission Impossible personally.
Yeah, that's the hard thing. I know both of you are huge Woo fans, and I like John Woo a lot.
Yeah.
But I think for Mission Impossible and looking at it as a whole, what it's become, that Brad Bird is a more important linchpin than J.J. Abrams, who just came in and did a reset.
Yeah, I personally, I like J.J. Abrams.
Everything.
Yeah.
More.
Yeah. I personally, I like Abrams's work. I like what he did with it more, but it does feel like an outlier. Brad Bird, feels like he did the most important things for it.
And by the way, a thing that I don't think really gets enough recognition, because it's one thing to come in as a director. It's another to be like, hey, take three directors worth of stuff and make that work.
Right.
I can't even imagine wrapping my head around that challenge right there.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to the music. The music is always a big part of these movies. The original Mission Impossible, music by Danny Elfman. Mission Impossible 2, a little more electronic score by Hans Zimmer.
And by the way, I want to point out, you're missing Limp Bizkit.
Yes, thank you.
As one of the music. So I don't know why. It must be.
Yeah, you must have forgot.
Dab a little bit. Yeah,
I forgot.
If we're going to do
/ Bizkit.
Well, let's just have a separate category that's original song. And that MI2 wins that automatically. So MI2 is going to get one win.
There you go.
MI2 is going to get Limp Bizkit, by far the best original song of the six movies.
Far and away.
And the limpest biscuit of all of them. There's so many biscuits too firm in the other ones. This one is super limp.
Well, look, I know we've determined the winner of this category, but I would like to give a shout out to what Michael Giacchino did in introducing a full-on orchestral, like, that's all that it is. There's no real electronica, big sections. Like, his score is a full-on orchestra playing music specific to every city that they go to in these movies.
Giacchino's it's biased here for me, because Giacchino's maybe my favorite living composer, but also I think, in my opinion, like, the best action composer. Mm-hmm. And I think it comes from both from video games doing Medal of Honor, but like working with Pixar, he composes action scores. I mean, I love Zimmer. Like, I listened to The Rock and Crimson Tide soundtrack like my entire life. Yeah. But Giacchino scores action scenes almost like a Looney Tunes. Like, every single beat.
Bring, that, bam, bam,
like he,
beep,
beep. Exactly. It doesn't feel like he just writes a theme and it kind of plays over. like he directs, he writes everything like a cartoon. And, you know, it's a natural progression from seeing his work in Incredibles and Ratatouille to suddenly in Mission Impossible 3 and 4. I love Giacchino.
Yeah.
And the combination of him and Brad Bird, which they had worked together.
Yeah.
For Pixar, like it's, that's a fun sort of, you know, Spielberg and Williams kind of thing.
Yeah.
So would you go for his
first movie? I don't think I remember the score of the other ones. Like, not that they're bad. It's just a very subtle.
Right.
Elfman is like, especially now going back to the first one, distinctive on
which is
almost goofy. Like, I almost was laughing and stuff. I'm like, wait, I don't remember it being like this goofy. And it's not that it's goofy, it's more in line with the original television series.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And can I, while you mentioned the original television series, there's one thing that I love about these movies, with the exception of Mission Impossible 2, because it was the only one that didn't do this, is they put like half second clips from the movie as the opening title sequence.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, as if it is a television show that has already had it, like the old Mission Impossible show, which I think is, I was like, are these just clips for like, is this, it makes it feel like an episodic television show, which I think is really cool.
I mean, Mission Impossible 2 was too busy wowing you with Tom Cruise climbing
Come on.
Yeah, free soloing.
Just as a quick note, like, you, and then the other two, obviously, you have Joe Kramer and Lauren Balfe. Balfe's an interesting one, just because he's from kind of the Hans Zimmer school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for those, you know, for we have some friends who are like, you know, film composers, and USC, where Matt and I met, has a big like film composing program. It is interesting because from the Zimmer school, a lot of times secretly, when you see a score by Hans Zimmer, there's a good chance that he's gotten help from people who eventually then become the like Harry Gregson Williamses of the world and those sort of.
He's got like a big studio.
He's a big old studio. Everyone kind of chips in. You can, there's a tone, there's a sound, there's a brand around Zimmer. So in a way, Balfe kind of represents sort of that Zimmer-esque kind of sound that comes into it. And, you know, and also comes in with a bit of video game experience as well. So I just think that, and then I think, and I believe Kramer was just McQuarrie bringing him from Reacher specifically because, and then also Way of the Gun. But I think to me, those ones are, they're taking their cue off of the template that Giacchino set.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you want Giacchino in Mission Impossible 3 or Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol? I feel like if we give it to 3, that will be the only thing 3 wins. And
Not true at all.
No?
Uh-oh.
Not
true? No.
Oh, probably villain.
Absolutely. We'll get to villains.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay,
sure.
Not the high point of the series, anyways. Oh, not that they need great villains.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, we can give it to Ghost Protocol then. Yeah. Do we like Ghost Protocol? Is that what we like?
I think so. It's
Bird and Giacchino together.
Yeah.
Come on, that's peanut butter and jelly, baby.
Right?
Yeah. All right. So locations?
That's just like this. So this show goes all over the world.
It's a globetrotting show.
It's a globetrotting show.
Sure.
Here are the cities that they visited in each one. In the original, it was Prague and London, mostly with a little bit of Washington, D.C. John Woo's version, most of the movie is set in Sydney and the Outback with a great sequence in Seville. J.J. Abrams' movie is Rome, specifically the Vatican. Berlin, but you never really see it as Berlin. It's just kind of like a nondescript place. And then a climax is in Shanghai. In Ghost Protocol, they go everywhere. Budapest, Moscow, Dubai, Mumbai, San Francisco, and then finally the denouement in Seattle.
That always cracks me up in that movie because I'm from Seattle originally. And I'm like, what the hell are you guys doing? Guys, like, it's not the same level. Yeah. Yes, the Budapest of the Northwest. We have a, like, Dubai has the tallest building in the world. Seattle has something from the 40s from the World Fair that's like broke. Yeah. Like, there's a restaurant there that spins around once an hour. That's it.
Yeah. That essentially points to the problem with the movie. Yeah. It builds and builds in Dubai, and then it just can't ever quite hit that again.
Well, I like that it makes sense, though, because at the end of the movie, think about where they've been. They've been scaling the world's largest building.
Yeah.
A Moscow prison.
The Kremlin.
A nuke headed for San Francisco. Yeah. The Kremlin. So after all of that, And you finally beat the guy. It's like, you know what, man? I just want to go somewhere where it's quiet, where I get some coffee and some guys throwing fish. And I just want to chill there.
To be fair, the problem I have is like the end action scene is one thing. They just went small scale, like, okay, now we're in San Francisco, but then they go into this like sci-fi parking lot. Like, so they're like, okay, so this is clearly supposed to feel huge. But yeah. It is just a little bit goofy. Again, love the movie. But
yeah. Is this and then finally,
Facebook.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And then in Rogue Nation, they start in Minsk, go to Vienna for that great opera scene. Much of the movie is in Paris, and then it ends in Casablanca.
Sorry, just really quick. I just needed to double check this. Mm-hmm. I want to just point out one last thing about Seattle, which is, I know Seattle. Again, like I said, I grew up in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Seattle is really close to Vancouver, which is a much cheaper city to shoot in, which means when they were in Seattle, and I've double checked this, that's not Seattle even. That's Granville Island in Vancouver.
Oh my God. Of course.
They didn't even do real Seattle. I was like, what are you doing?
They ran out of money.
They're showing you the real San Francisco. They are like, at least you see a landmark. You don't even get anything from Seattle. Anyway, that's everything that's wrong with ending in Seattle summed up in a single thing. Sorry.
They did pay a Sean Kemp impersonator to walk around in the background of a lot of the shots to go.
He passed to a Detlef Shrimp lookalike.
Yeah, exactly. Look at that, Sedale Threat.
That was just drilling threes in the background.
That's right.
All right. And then we also have in that movie after Casablanca, they also visited Oxford and London. And then finally in Fallout, Berlin, Paris, and the Siachen Glacier in Kashmir were the locations in that final one. I mean,
I feel like a broken record, but like, how can you beat the Kremlin and Dubai?
Yeah, like that. You break into the.
Yes, I agree. But I think in 5, it felt sexier. I don't know. It 4 felt like set pieces, whereas 5 felt like a spy thriller. And that
I can't even tell you. I guess I can't. I can barely remember the. I guess like it feels like they go to cool places, but like it doesn't feel like the locations were like the stars. And also, I feel like the locations in 4. Like the Kremlin as a location is like, okay, you're going to break into the Kremlin. You don't have to explain it. Whereas like when they go to Paris, you have to like set up, like, what are they doing in Paris? Right. And like when you go to Dubai, it's like, obviously we're going to go to the tallest building in the world. So he's going
to
climb it.
Yeah, like, but to me, that's like a circus. That's like being like, oh, this movie went to the Eiffel Tower and then it went to Big Ben. And then they went and look at the Statue of Liberty. It's like, come on, Matt.
Well, what's the location in 5? What happens in 5?
More culture than that. The opera house.
Yeah, the
Vienna Opera House scene.
Yeah, the Vienna Opera House is beautiful. Yeah.
Oh, but it's not a recognizable place on a postcard, so I don't think it's a good place, Matt. Come on.
Like I say, the Kremlin is a hell of a location, and they use it so well.
Yeah, as seen in the background of Tetris.
The location, he makes more use out of a hallway in the Kremlin. There's so much good stuff in the Kremlin whenever you go back to do it.
Yeah.
Besides the hallway, it's also the mask and then pretending to be Russian, and Simon Pegg can't do an accent, and there's just so much good stuff.
Just Russia comedy. That's what sold you, huh?
Yeah, it's really darn good. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. You suddenly put an opera. You put an opera music over something else, and it's got to be instantly better. This is more cultured.
Yeah, it was so much cooler because to me, there's a certain like. Here's what it is. There's a certain like obviousness, and I'm not saying that Mission Impossible is doing this compared to other movies, but it's a certain level of just like, I get it. You're in Dubai. You're going to just you're doing the biggest building, of course, because you're in Dubai, right?
Right.
Whereas it's so much harder to get like the feeling of Eastern Europe, right? The feeling of France.
Which they do for Budapest at the beginning of that, I think, beautifully.
Budapest in 5 a lot more. I was about to say, it's like, are you saying you've never seen a spy movie that takes place in like a theater or an opera house before? It's like the most common location in the world.
Just because if you want to do a spy movie, you're just like every single one's like the snipers on the Eiffel Tower and you got to do these obvious landmarks. To me, it's like, I don't know. It just feels a little gauche. What can I say?
You know, when you go to
the actual location of the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah. Every time you go to an opera or a live theater show, the audience is 80% spies.
Yeah.
They're not all interactive. There are like 20 different missions going on. Yeah,
do not get a seat in a box.
And the show backstage, way more entertaining than what's on stage a lot of the time, because they're all trying to kill each other back there too.
Frankly, I just wish more movies. I do wish there was more landmarks. I want the next one to be at the Eiffel Tower. That's what I pay for. I want the Great Wall of China. Yeah. I want the Eiffel Tower. I want like famous locations. That's what I want.
I'm with
want,
you, man. Give me famous locations.
I want
give me
famous locations. Trying to hold up the Leaning Tower of Pisa and people taking pictures.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you see a quick shot of it going on someone's Instagram and it gets a bunch of likes. And then like, oh, we're gonna have to disappear.
Freddie's like, the best disaster movies, I love it when a tidal wave like wipes out my basement and like takes out a movie theater. I don't want to see New York get taken out.
Don't you get going on this. Disaster movies are different because the spectacle of a disaster movie is about blowing up well-known locations, whereas the spectacle of a spy movie is not to visit a bunch of tourist spots, man.
Yes, he breaks into the Kremlin and climbs the tallest building in the world. Literally, those two sentences are the most exciting sentences of the entire series.
So,
and then he gets into some fish and chips in the middle of Vancouver in Seattle.
Yeah.
B4 doesn't get it because of the it could not stick the landing.
Like, and okay, it's Father's Day, and I go to my dad. He's like, hey, you want to watch Mr. Possible? He goes, which one? I got two options for you. I got one where he breaks in the Kremlin and climbs the World's Tallest Building, and one where he goes see opera. Well, what is he going to watch?
Just like in gymnastics in the Olympics, Matt, if you don't stick the landing, the whole thing doesn't count and you lose points.
That's fair.
All right, gentlemen.
Okay.
If I may.
To your corners.
Referee.
To your corners. Holy cow. I'm glad you gave us that warning at the beginning.
Mark, don't you feel better about the time we got angry deciding best pretzel shape? And we wound up with pretzel rods out of spite.
Is that what the debate was about? That you went, it was a pretzel?
Yeah.
And he wanted to eliminate the Philly soft pretzel, and I'm from Philadelphia.
Oh,
that wasn't happening.
That's cruel.
So Hal eliminated pretzel shape from best pretzel shape.
It's dumb. The rod is great. You bite that. You bite it in half this way, and it becomes a little spoon for your
Hal, I think you're describing what happens when betas fight. We just witnessed what happens when alphas fight.
Look at my belly. Let me show it to you. Look at this belly. It's full of pretzel rods.
So I'm going to say it's Ghost Protocol. Budapest, Moscow, Dubai, Mumbai. Yeah, climb the world's tallest building and blow up the Kremlin.
Stop by Vancouver.
And show up in Granville Island, a weird part of Vancouver with two breweries and nothing else. I will cast my vote for 5, and nothing will change my mind.
What's the Supreme Court do? You're going to write
the dissent?
Yeah, you're going to write dissenting opinion after all this.
Are you going to wear your dissent collar?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to wear my wig. I'm going to get on this.
All right. Let's move on to best team. You've got the original team, which is the OG team at the beginning of the movie that De Palma kills off in the first half hour, which is brilliant, leading to the whole story. You've also got Claire Phelps and Luther on the team. Krieger as well, but he turns out to be a villain, so I put him in that column. Second movie, you got Naya, Luther
so
again. Oh yeah, Claire turns out to be a villain too, I guess.
Yep.
I guess
him and Luther.
Pretty much everybody becomes villains.
It's pretty much just him and Luther. Yeah, everybody's a villain in that one.
As soon as Kristen Scott Thomas and Emilio Estevez get killed, you're like, what am I even doing here?
Yeah, it's insane. And then part three, you've got Jen and Declan along with Luther.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the crazy you've got the crazy Aussie in part two, the crazy Aussie pilot.
Yeah.
William Bad, call me Billy. it's William Bad. Billy's fine. And then in Ghost Protocol, you've got Jane and Benji and Brandt, the introduction of Brandt. Then in Rogue Nation, Ilsa appears for the first time. Alec Baldwin's CIA agent Hunley and Benji is back. And then in Fallout, you've got Ilsa again, Luther, Benji, and the newest addition to the team.
Superman,
Henry Cavill.
You reading those kind of points out to me. And again, it's not even a flaw of the series, but honestly, I don't know who any of those people are until you say the actor's name.
Fair.
Like the character names, I'm just like, oh yeah, the Mission Impossible characters, you know.
All right.
But I understand them now. It's just, I think it points to like how the movies feel like Tom Cruise and his famous friends doing stuff more than like necessarily like human characters.
Yeah.
I would say Luther is the only one of the teams that has the most name recognition just because of just sheer repetition. This is an interesting list because in each, right away, what stands out to me is like one is the introduction of Luther, four, the introduction of Benji, and then five, the introduction of Ilsa, who then become these beloved sort of, right? Like,
Rebecca Ferguson is like the star to me. Like, she's incredible in 5. And honestly, I'm not the biggest fan of her in 6. Like, I don't like what they do with her as much in 6. So, like, it's tough. Like, the team in 5 is really fun because there's a lot of the same team in 4. But, like, her, like, the addition of her is just, like, something the team needed, I think.
I agree. And I think that she is the one that is going to carry this category for Rogue Nation.
I want to give some love to Paula Patton as Jane.
I did not like Paula Patton's Jane.
She was great.
Who is this?
She was one in 4 who joined the team.
Lover
had been killed.
Yeah, she's pretty good. I like her.
For some reason, it's just that scene specifically.
Mm-hmm.
That scene where Agent Josh Holloway gets killed, and she has her moment in that. Now she does some, she does some ass whooping in it.
Mm-hmm.
But that scene in particular, I was like, she just feels, I hate to say it, not ready for prime time.
That's weird because she's, that character at least, is one of the few females who is an IMF agent that is on a team. Ilsa is MI6. Mm-hmm. And
she's her own thing. But Ilsa, when she shows up, you're like, okay, Ilsa is definitely the match to Ethan Hunt.
Yeah, I guess that's what it is. Maybe I'm just so used to seeing everybody chew so much scenery in it, and then a realistic portrayal appears on screen, and I do not recognize.
I don't think you can overstate how incredible an acting performance it is from Rebecca Ferguson to be on screen with Tom Cruise, and you take your eye away from Tom Cruise, and she commands the screen.
His movie,
yes, like
movies into his series.
Like Tom Cruise is whatever you say about it, like he is the movie star every time he's on screen. Like, oh yeah, this guy's like one of the greatest movie stars of all time.
The fact that in 5, the very beginning, he just does like a smile to the bookstore clerk, and you're like, literally that single smile, I'm like, that man's a movie star. That little smile there has more charisma in that frame than like entire movies.
Tom Cruise is made of charisma, and he's excellent in all of these movies.
Yeah, but yeah, she's amazing. I just love, honestly, that's probably one of the high points of the movies as it goes on. I mean, I love, Dubai to me is like the most fun team sequence, because I love Simon Pegg in that sequence and everything. But, like, yeah, I mean, I like Isla. I don't even know her name. Rebecca Ferguson so much. Yeah. Ilsa so much that my vote's probably 5.
Yeah, and I think that Benji gets kind of reduced to – he starts off, like, super fun. But I think as time goes on, he kind of becomes the default – comic relief, let's just throw it to him kind of thing. So he's kind of like, oh, he's the tech guy who's – and, like, I think Simon Pegg is great in that role, but I also am like, how many times at this point in movies have we seen like the tech guy who's complaining about you messing with his gadgets? Like,
which I thought was great. I thought it was great that they put him on the team, that he's a field agent.
Yeah.
When he becomes a field agent in 4.
Because he's introduced in 3, but he's basically Q. They were setting up to be Q. Exactly. And then
4, he's a blast. The whole dynamic with him and Tom Cruise is just, that scene in the Kremlin with the two of them is like comic genius.
Mm-hmm. And Alec Baldwin coming in 5 too is great. Like,
yeah, he's good in that role.
I think he's really fun, and he just whispers everything that he says, as always.
Which is
just Alec Baldwin actively whispering,
right? Because in 3, they're pulling in Morpheus, right, Lawrence Fishburne, for a similar kind of thing, and it's like, yeah, I think there's just something about the overall framing of 3 that just felt like these guest stars felt like TV guest stars, whereas there's a weight, I think, in terms of the direction in the later movies with supporting actors in these on the team roles that I think just has a different flavor to it.
Also, when Lawrence Fishburne shows up, I want him to whoop ass. Like, I want him to kick butt. Yeah. Like, Alec Baldwin shows up, I'm like, yeah, you're a bureaucrat. You're good at your job. Like, I don't want you to kick ass. You weren't in the Matrix.
Lawrence Fishburne
comes in, I'm like, you got to put him in this movie. He's got to kick some butt. That's also what I have with him in John Wick. I'm like, come on, give him a gun.
Put down the bird and pick up a gun already.
Yeah,
that's awesome. True. That's true. It'd be like, it would be like Bruce Lee showing up in like an acting role. You'd be like, he kicks someone, right? At some point. What are they doing then? Why did they pay him money to be in this? And he's not going to punch someone.
He just plays the accountant. He just shows up. He's helping with finances. That's it.
He's like kind of just checking everyone's 401ks. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yep. Fishburne. Okay. Morpheus. You should. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
No. All right. So, what are we saying for the team? Do we think that the team of Benji, once he gets on the team, and Brant and Jane is better? Do they beat Ilsa coming in 5 and just dominating?
Which Brant is also in. He's also
which Brant is also in 5. Yeah,
it's got to be 5.
I think it's got to be 5 too.
I think so too. I even love that bookend of I can neither confirm nor deny anything without the Secretary's approval. That mm-hmm. way they bookend that at the beginning and end is really, really nice.
I'll just give a shout out to, I think, Fallout. I like that the end of Fallout's end action scene is all about the team working together.
Yes.
Which is a high point of that movie. But yes, I think the team, like, and I like Ilsa way more in 5 than I think.
Yeah. And even his wife helping in Fallout.
Which is
joining the team.
Which is what, right? That's the thing that they introduce in 3, which is I've always like, it's like the one thing that makes the Mission Impossible series stand out to me. Cause it's like Bond is right. This rogue brooding bachelor forever. Right?
Yeah.
The Fast and Furious guys, they have each other. Everyone's on their own family. And that's like, and Tom Cruise and then like Ethan Hunt, married man. You're like, it's weird. Did not expect. it's just always weird. I don't know. It's a flavor that is unique to Mission Impossible. That you
my weird thing would be it helps it be a more PG-13 version of Bond. It lets the series is desexualized because it's like he's a married man.
Yeah,
you know, like he's not. This isn't Bond. He's not gonna have sex on the mission.
Bond is gonna have like dirty, like mean sex with. Like,
meanwhile, John Woo's just gonna be a little bit naughty and put some boobs in your face in a bathtub.
Yes, a very unsexy scene.
Yeah,
very awkward.
We're just actually just talking about this, where it's like it's weird because the sexiest scene in that movie is the cars.
The cars like, make cars love on the cliffside.
Like, yeah.
Like, and that's, by the way, sexier than most actual movie sex scenes. So it's like, he managed to do something with cars.
We're restraining ourselves so much to not just make this an entire podcast about analyzing John Woo. Because as we were watching it, we were just doing Discord. And I was like, I realized that John Woo's villains are all sexualized, from like Hard Target, where he's got a single reloading rifle that he acts as very clearly a metaphor for his dick. And Face Off, literally, once he becomes a villain, he becomes sexualized and he has sex with his wife. Again, and then in this movie it's the same thing. It's like the villain in Mission Impossible 2 is like the mirror to John Woo and to Ethan Hunt, not as well as Face Off, as the same thing. And again, he talks about having sex with Fanny Newton's character the whole time, and Ethan Hunt's just this like celibate monk. Like a very Catholic thing that John Woo does. Anyways,
well, you threw it beautifully to our next category, which is the villains. And this is, I think this one's pretty easy, but I will read them all. Mission Impossible, the original, you've got Phelps is played by John Voight, turns out to be bad. Krieger, what's his name, come on, movie guys, Renault, Jean Renault.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Claire, Phelps's wife, they turn, and, Max as well, Vanessa Redgrave's, she's not really the bad guy. She's just, you know, the money person behind the bad guys. But she is wonderful, just scenery chewing. And then you've got, in Mission Impossible 2, you've got sort of anti Ethan Hunt in Ambrose. And then in Mission Impossible 3, you have the sadistic Davian, as played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. Also, what's his name? Musgrave, the government bureaucrat who turns out to be the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Ghost Protocol, you've got Cobalt and the assassin, the blonde assassin, Moreau. And then in the last two movies, Rogue Nation and Fallout, you've got Lane is the villain and his group, the Syndicate, which is
a great villain name.
Just the Syndicate.
Well, the Syndicate. Oh, Lane. And then Lane.
The Syndicate much feels like, hey, we're all a bunch of bad guys. Who wants to do the logo? All right. What do you think? The Syndicate, the crew, you know, it's like, come on, guys, the Syndicate really couldn't come up with anything else. Like, this is me and Matt on Xbox trying to come up with a clan name. The first thing we come up with, Syndicate.
All the villains in the first one. They don't really count because you just know them as bad guy, or you know them as good guys through most of the movie, and then they flip, right?
Mark.
What?
Mark. Do we need to march through all these movies when Davian is so clearly better than every single
than every
one of them?
Other, like, thing? This is one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's best roles.
Yeah.
He is memorable. Right. He's, again, I don't remember what he does as a villain, but like.
Yeah, I don't even know what his thing is.
His performance is so good.
It's just money. Really, he's an arms dealer. That's it.
Yeah.
It's the weakest point of the series, which, like, it's also to the point of the series that doesn't really matter, like, what the plots are half the time. It's kind of just like, they're doing spy shit. Like, it's fine. Whatever it is. But he makes, I will say, Ambrose is not a good villain, but maybe this gets into the MacGuffin. I do think the actual villain idea for MI2 is one of the only ones I can actually remember after watching the movie, because it makes sense. It actually works pretty well. But he himself is, like, not great.
One thing that Ambrose did, and this goes into a little bit into the tech as well, but Ambrose introduced that the villains can have the masks as well.
Yeah.
And also the voice changer. That was one cool thing that Wu did in Mission Impossible 2 was the added a voice changer so that if you're in the mask, you can talk, but there's no question.
No, you're about to change my mind now. Cause I'm like, you know what though? Ambrose freaking throws down. All the other girls are like hiding and Wilson Robbins sits on a plane and complains and talks.
To Ambrose?
Ambrose gets on a motorcycle and charges 100 miles per hour in Ethan Hunt. So I will say that what Ambrose does have is he actually fights.
Yeah.
That's like, true. So, well, so Philip Seymour Hoffman, Davian fights at the end. I mean, he has to implant a chip in his brain first. Look, man, I don't think there's any question.
No, there's no question. But I had to try.
And that Ambrose scene.
Ambrose is the only one who threw himself on the motorcycle and they clashed in the midair because of the motorcycles. And no one else can say that. Lane
can't
say that.
That's true.
Lane was in a straitjacket and he almost drowned. That's the best he could do, huh, Lane?
Well, I don't know.
Lane gets caught in a hotel room and whoever was the guy in four falls off a parking structure.
Yeah, he jumps off a parking structure.
Yes.
Though, don't forget about Fallout. Superman, Burnface Superman can fight.
That's true.
Henry Cavill at the end of Fallout.
Mustache the whole time.
Every time I saw Doug Ray Scott, who plays Ambrose in Mission Impossible 2, I was like, yeah, you could have been Wolverine. This is what you chose instead of being Wolverine.
Was it
play
really?
A guy who dies at the end of his movie.
Oof. Terrible
versus
idea.
It was like nobody talked it. Like his agent was like, look, I don't know what comic books are. I've never even picked up one of them. I know you buy them in drugstores. You should do the Mission Impossible movie.
I do know 60s television.
Yeah. There's no way he kept his agent after that. There's just no way. There's no way on earth.
Can I say to the people of the world, listen or watch that clip, if you can find it, of Davian when he is on the plane or not. Is it before the plane or on the plane?
I think it's on the plane, the famous scene where he's talking.
Oh, yeah, where he says, you know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like the thing that he knows, it's fascinating to me to watch a villain who knows that he's dealing with people who have guns and he has an army and a fighter jet drone. Like he's like, guys, you know what's, he's like, there's no question in his mind and his calculated delivery of that monologue is, it's one of the best villain monologues I've ever seen in a movie in its pure, like David Mamet Atlantic Theater simplicity.
Yeah. He's also the Joker in The Dark Knight when he's being when Batman's trying to intimidate him. He's like, you have no power over me.
Yeah.
I know you won't kill me. And there's something to him being dangled over the cargo hold and him cutting the straps. Where he looks like he doesn't want to fall out of a plane, but also doesn't seem convinced that it's going to happen. Which is
he is just that
no
dead stare. He just dead stares.
He's just
at
like,
him.
Tell me who your family is.
I'm gonna find you. And bomb in the head is a pretty visceral, good thing for a villain to do.
Yeah, that's a no-brainer there. Yeah. Davian wins. All right, let's talk about bombs in the head. Let's move on to tech.
Should we take a break?
We've been going. This is epic.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to hear from some of the other podcasts on the Maximum Fun Network, including maybe Story Break that you should be checking out. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm James, host of Minority Corner, which is a
podcast that's all about intersectionality. It's hosted by James with a guest host every week.
Discussing all sorts of wonderful issues, nerdy and political.
Pop culture.
Black, queer, feminism.
Race, sexuality.
News.
You're going to learn your history, their self-empowerment, and it's told by what feels like your best friend.
Why should someone listen to Minority Corner?
Why not?
Oh my God, free stuff.
There's not free stuff.
The listeners of Minority Corner will enjoy some necessary LOLs, but mainly a look at what's happening in our world through a colorful lens.
People will get the perspective of marginalized communities.
I feel heard. I feel seen.
Like you said, you need to understand how to be more proactive in your community, and this is a great way to get started.
Join us every Friday on Max Fun or wherever you get your podcast.
Minority Corner. Because together we're the majority.
You wept as we crafted the tragic tale of Jar Jar, a Star Wars story.
Yeah. Dude, like, he forgives Darth Vader. Lisa still love you, Annie.
You gasped out loud at the shocking twists of Face Off 2, Faces Wild.
He takes his kid's face.
What?
We're writing an entire screenplay week by week on Story Break Season 2, Heaven Heist.
Hey folks, Freddie Wong here with some exciting news about Story Break, the Writer's Room podcast where three Hollywood professionals have 1 hour to spin cinematic gold. We're shaking up our format by turning Heaven Heist, one of our favorite ideas we've ever come up with on the show, into a full screenplay.
Heaven Heist is an action comedy about a crew of misfit gangsters robbing the Celestial Bank of Heaven. Think of Coco meets Point Break.
Join us as we write this crazy movie scene by scene and get an inside look at the screenwriting process on our podcast Story Break every Thursday on MaximumFun.org.
And we're back. All right. We have four more categories. The first one I want to talk about, this is one of the big fun things in the Mission Impossible movies, and that's all the crazy tech that they introduce us to. So I'll try to go through this quickly. In the first Mission Impossible, they introduce ultra somehow realistic masks on people, exploding gum, red light, green light that you pinch together, and of course, their version of the internet.
Huge in 96. Huge.
Yeah, yeah. Huge in 96. Oh, yeah. It was just coming out. It's all, he's searching use groups, or Usenet groups.
Yeah.
God, he's
Usenet.
Yeah. And,
Bible Usenet groups, no less.
And an email address had a colon after the at symbol. And I was like, guys, that's not how.
That.
And also everything's code name is like code name secret project.
That time period, 90s movie depictions of technology is my
favorite.
It's
so fun.
Like everything from Sandra Bullock's The Net to everything. It's just like, guys, wow, AOL really did a number on you.
Yeah, no kidding. He's like, I'm going to find out what this problem is if I have any of the 1,000 hours left on this AOL CD.
Yeah. I'm going to hack into the mainframe.
All right. Then Mission Impossible 2, as we mentioned before, introduces that villains have the masks too, and now there's a voice changer. Mission Impossible 3 introduces the exploding
brain. Mission Impossible 2 also introduced the idea of automobiles with only two wheels. They're called motorcycles.
Oh, yes, that's true.
And I know they existed beforehand, but they weren't ever really used correctly until Tom Cruise got on them in Mission Impossible 2.
That's true. Good point.
Part 3 introduced the exploding brain chip, which becomes a major plot point. And then Ghost Protocol introduces the invisibility screen, which is super cool. And the new 3D mask printer.
Also, it's like his magnet climbing to get on the side of the building.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The magnet gloves that blue means glue, red means dead.
Such a good scene.
And then Rogue Nation introduced the Kremlin gate sensors, is just one little bit of it. And, the gloves that, tell you how much oxygen you have in your body.
Let's be frank. You know how much oxygen you have when you hold your breath.
Yeah. That's yeah, exactly.
The audience. How much oxygen you have.
Exactly.
Doesn't your iPhone do that now? That's not that impressive. Yeah.
And then, of course, Mission Impossible Fallout has the ability to recreate the entirety of CNN, including Wolf Blitzer's face and a portable face scanner. Am I missing any of the big ones? I feel like the big ones in this are which movie used the masks the best?
And
the exploding brain chip is pretty cool. But
MI2,
the invisibility screen is great.
MI2, if we're going to say masks, MI2 definitely has the best mask because it's the only one that has the double mask where it's the bad guy's mask. It's Ethan Hunt's mask over the bad guy's mask for that final moment at the end there when he tricks the bad guy.
Yeah,
it's the
just,
best
it's
mask
just,
reveal.
It's Ethan Hunt using the mask on someone else, which is just random flunky.
Yes.
To it's this day, one of the best build-ups where you're like, oh my, it is, I do think that sequence is, in the same way 3 starts with that bang where you're like, whoa, like, I can't believe they're actually doing this.
Mm-hmm.
2 has that moment, you're like, whoa, did he not lose that fight? Oh, they just shot, like, I remember when I first saw that being like, just like, oh no, Tom Cruise is dead. And then when Limp Bizkit comes and he's running around the slow-mo track up and rips off the mask and still Ethan Hunt, that was one of the formulas of the experience for me at a young age.
Also, the movie starts with Ethan Hunt killing a guy. And then you realize somebody else is using Ethan Hunt's face. It's also a very good reveal of the mask.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of cool tech. The invisibility screen. I do want to talk about that.
I mean, that's one of the great. That's maybe the greatest sequence.
It's so good.
The idea that if you want to Wile E. Coyote a hallway, you can actually do it as long as the camera knows where the viewer's eyes are on the other side of the screen and adjust the projection accordingly.
So that is one of the, so totally cool. One of the weirdest things, one of the weirdest filmmaking challenges maybe ever, which was that doesn't work in real life if it's, if you have binaural vision, right? Because you can see, like, you would see it as a flat screen. So when they made this movie for 3D, They were like, okay, how do we show what should be flat? If because we're in 3D now, this should have no depth, but we have to also tell the story that this should look like.
So what did they ultimately do?
I believe, if I remember correctly, seeing it in 3D, they just treat it as if it's a 3D hole.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's one of those weird ones where you're like, wait, technically, shouldn't this be not that? And anyway, it's just one of those weird. Some VFX supervisor sitting there was just like, what are we supposed to do here?
It's also,
somebody's mind got blown.
It's just the directing of that sequence is so incredible because I can't, if like, I feel like if there was like a wired, like YouTube video trying to explain that technology to somebody, they wouldn't understand it. And the film just so elegantly introduces this idea of face tracking camera that like can change the image so that when the guy walks, it still looks invisible. Like it does it so flawlessly that the whole, like you don't have to, they don't even have like an exposition scene to explain it. They just so effortlessly like just visually show how this thing.
Yeah.
It's a very
it's a Rube Goldberg.
Yeah.
It's beautifully done. I do want to add one that I forgot in Ghost Protocol at the beginning in Budapest. That's where they introduce the Terminator eye, where you have a scleral lens that can scan faces and get information. Previously it was just a thing in your eye that meant you had the brain chip and it would explode you.
Yep.
Brain chip's definitely up there, though. It doesn't seem like something new. Like, they put a bomb in your head.
Yeah.
It's the same thing in 4.
Yeah.
Like, you can instantly say the, like, 3 gadgets, and you can remember the scenes exactly how they play out. You're like,
It's the integration of it. It's the integration.
Let's give it up for the exploding gum, though, because that, like, rocked my mind as a kid.
Yeah.
Yep. For the longest time, anytime I saw gum that had, like, 2 colors on it, I was like, no way. Like, this could be the one. Like, it's a good gadget. It's just a very simple, visceral.
Frankly, it's an all-timer gadget because it's like, it's just the right blend of like this sort of Cold War, probably could be, feels like it could be real.
Yeah.
Of stuff. Whereas the masks, like, as the movies go
are
on,
bonkers.
Like, you're just like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Even by the time they reuse it in the later movies, it's almost like, I remember the audience I was in was like, kind of chuckled at it because of just how ridiculous it was. But you're not into
Well, they made it a joke for Benji, too, that he just wants a mask. He spends 3 movies wanting to put on a mask.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it becomes this sort of thing. And then as time goes on, it just gets crazier and crazier. But like, exploding gum is still the one that's just like the realistic Cold War-esque gadget that feels like it could be a thing. And it feels like was inspired by a real thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good gadget.
Yeah. Shout out to that.
It's pretty incredible. And that it's got a catchphrase that goes with it.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Red light, green light.
Yep.
But I think the winner here is, Ghost Protocol with the invisibility screen, the magnetic gloves, the contact lens, everything. All right. So let's move on now to the MacGuffin, the thing they are all chasing. This seems like another pretty easy one. The first movie, you have the knock list, the list of all the agents. The second movie, you have Bellerophon, the antidote or the antiviral to the virus chimera. The third movie, you have the rabbit's foot, which I don't even remember what it is.
No.
Something that they just called the rabbit's foot that doesn't matter. But I love in Fallout in Rogue Nation that Ilsa picks up a key on a rabbit's foot keychain, which I thought was cool. In Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, launch codes, nuclear launch codes, a classic, Rogue Nation, some syndicate info on a USB, who cares, whatever. And then Mission Impossible Fallout, it's 3 nuclear balls full of plutonium, but it's just these 3 big silver balls. Like, they literally, by the 6th movie, were just like, just give 3 silver balls that everybody's chasing. Like, these really don't matter, I think, with the exception, as you said before, of Bellerophon.
Yeah, I'm going to put my foot on
Bellerophon.
It's not only that, is that the MacGuffin becomes her character. Like, it's not like it is in order to save her, they have to get it. So it's not just like a random object. Like, once she injects herself, it becomes like she becomes like you're invested on a character level in the story as opposed to like the launch codes or whatever it is. So I'm a fan of, you know, that the Mission Impossible 2 is written by the guy who wrote Chinatown.
Yeah, Robert Towne. No,
so
yeah,
Robert Towne. Idea that he also wrote Mission Impossible 2.
Yep, was often the greatest screenplay of all time. Also wrote Mission Impossible 2. It's one of those things where it's like when you watch it, you can kind of tell there's just not quite a connect between that script and John Woo. But
what's kind of brilliant about it.
Yeah, well, we've already all agreed it's the best one. We're talking about the second best here.
Sure.
I mean, so, because also, by the way, Bellerophon allows you to have you know, the most intense, like, I will find you again, right? Like, just straight out of Last of the Mohicans style.
Yeah.
Diving out. Like, Ethan has never been that passionate in any other movie except for that moment when he's, like, trying to get out of this building and he's shooting with his two guns and he's got to jump out of the base jump. Like, that's so good. Like peak cinema. It's so good.
Well, in the final...
Not just peak... Not just peak Mission Impossible, peak cinema.
Peak cinema.
Yeah. Absolutely peak cinema. Because it's like they are able to have this intense conversation where, while like the stunt guys in the background are having this like, this gunfight, he can't get both of them out. The look on Tom Cruise's face when she's like, can't get both of us out. He's like, I can't. You know, it's like, it's just, it feels so intense. The emotion of that moment is just so over the top.
The simplicity of, because basically, the MacGuffin category is kind of the plot category.
Yeah.
It's that, they at one point in the movie, they even say, it's just that simple. And he goes, yeah, it's just that simple.
And also, by the way, I know at the time we were all these cynical, like, oh, isn't it funny that the villain in Mission Impossible 2 is he wants stock options? Take a look around the world and you tell me who the villains are. And you tell me that that idea of some corporate guy manipulating stuff and getting to get money in corporate, you tell me that's outlandish then. Like, that's because we were naive back in the day.
Hey man, the guy wrote Chinatown. He's a smart dude.
Yeah.
Knock List to me is the close second though. The Knock List is it's a cool, cool Cold War-esque thing. We're like, ooh, what does that even mean? And it turns out that is a real, you know, acronym that the CIA uses. And of course that leads to maybe one of the top memorable sequences of the whole thing, which is just, you know, him in the server room and all that.
Which is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
All right. So it's clearly Bellerophon for that category. Yes.
By the way, the villain in that film, in Mission Impossible 2 is basically Martin Shkreli. He presaged that guy would exist. He wants to be let out of prison so he can work on a cure for COVID-19. That's what he's going to do with his time.
Yeah. Uh-huh. While listening to his one Wu-Tang. Copy of that Wu-Tang album.
Yeah.
So let's move on now. One hallmark of these movies, most of these movies, 5 out of 6 of these movies, is some sort of item that they need to get out of a secure vault in a location that requires a scene with planning. So everybody sits at a table. They plan out a heist of some sort of deep vault.
Yeah.
And they are as follows. In the first Mission Impossible, it's the famous on the cable scene at the CIA headquarters where they have to get a file out of that computer. The second movie, it's the biosite headquarters where they one up going through an air vent from, you know, one floor up down into the room to doing that exact stunt again, but this time from a helicopter into a 50-story atrium shaft. The third movie, Mission Impossible 3, they have to get into the Hengshan Lu building. That is when he, again, writes on the window and decides that they need a fulcrum to get them into the Hengshan Lu building to get the rabbit's foot or some part of the rabbit's foot. I don't know. Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, of course, has the famous Burj Khalifa, tallest tower in the world in Dubai. They've got to get to the server in that so that Benji can access it. And they have a big planning scene for that. Then, of course, the underwater version in Rogue Nation with the Casablanca power plant. And then in Mission Impossible Fallout, doesn't have exactly a vault dive like that, but it does have a planning session. And the big extraction in that one is Lane, the villain himself.
Yeah.
In that one. So that one kind of is not going to win this category. This, to me, feels like that original one.
Yeah. I mean, that's one. I mean, you can't really say it's like all of Dubai is that. I mean, that first scene in the first movie is one of the most famous movie scenes of all time, regardless of Mission Impossible. It's just like an all-timer sequence.
Yeah. And it's Brian De Palma executes it perfectly. The silence, the drop of sweat.
I still remember seeing that scene in theaters.
Stunning.
I still remember the audience reaction. I remember gasps when he catches the sweat drop.
And
I remember just being like, really kind of almost like as a kid, you know, like looking around being like, no other movie has like done something. Like I've never seen, at that point, I had never seen an audience so in the palm of a movie's hand like that.
Yeah.
Had done, which is like, it really blew my mind as a burgeoning film fan.
And what a great button on the end of that scene that they completely accomplish it. And then Jean Reno drops the knife and it lands point down into the desk.
It's so good.
It's what a, I mean, like they put the period on the end of that sentence from above with a knife falling into the table. Like that is,
yeah.
That one's got to be the winner.
They definitely go bigger in later films, but they don't do it better. It's a perfectly done scene.
Yeah. Speaking of perfectly done scenes, that takes us to our final category, and that is the big epic stunt action sequences. Which movie has the best of these? And those are from the first Mission Impossible. You've got the cable drop we just talked about, and also the helicopter versus train in the tunnel fight that ends the movie, which is wonderfully bonkers.
It feels like it's from the mid-90s.
Yeah.
Watch it out.
Oh, yeah. The second movie you've got, as mentioned before, the rock climbing opening sequence, the chopper drop atrium scene, the ridiculous version of the greatest scene.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the motorcycle fight followed by a brutal fist fight at the end of the movie.
And a knife that they actually drop like a centimeter away from his eye, which is a pretty cool.
Which is a very cool visual.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And probably the most dangerous stunt that he's ever done.
Like, they actually did that.
Because if you look at all of these and you're
did
like,
did they really do that with the
blade? In the behind the scenes, they just have a blade attached to like a big bar above him and he's in the sand and the guy just drops down with a knife and it stops because of a rope. And John Woo was like, I hope he doesn't move.
God bless.
Like when you look at even the, anyway, I'll let you finish the rest of it. I think that is the most dangerous stunt.
Probably.
Out of all of these.
And then in Mission Impossible 3, you've got that incredible helicopters through a wind farm chase at the beginning. You've also got the bridge, Philip Seymour Hoffman, hey, I have a fighter jet scene.
Yeah.
And that movie has one thing that has become a staple of these films is the villain after they make an escape midway through the movie waving from a helicopter at Ethan as he stares in disbelief. Ghost Protocol, you of course have the bombing of the Kremlin, that amazing climb up the tallest building in the world, the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, and the somewhat anticlimactic after that Dubai climb robot parking garage fight.
Great choreography of that, though.
Great choreography.
And the way it was filmed really well.
Speaking of great choreography, you have the Vienna Opera fight. This is Rogue Nation now. The beautifully executed Vienna Opera fight.
Yeah.
A great motorcycle race. That underwater dive into the Casablanca power plant. And then finally in Fallout, you have the helicopter fight, the climactic helicopter fight at the end that almost looks like Star Wars. You have a really funny, cool rooftop chase, which features, I think, the best version of Tom Cruise just flat out running, which happens in every one of these movies. The Halo jump, high altitude, low opening, and another brutal, without musical accompaniment, bathroom brawl where they mangle a face. They need to go in the bathroom to get this guy's face for the scan. And then the fight is so brutal. And
you forgot
the face.
You forgot the biggest stunt from 5, probably, which is the opening.
Yes.
On the outside of the airplane.
Thank you. The outside of the airplane.
Yes. Yeah,
at the opening of 5.
Yeah.
One of the biggest stunts ever for him, right?
Yeah.
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 So I will say this about 2. 1. So first and foremost, you don't have any of Tom Cruise getting his rocks off as a guy doing stunts without 2, right? So 2 is the beginning of all of that. That's him rock climbing at the beginning and a little bit of not quite, really free soloing, but there's definitely sequences where there's a net and he could get hurt.
Right.
A lot of these later on, I love the Burj Khalifa sequence. As far as like danger to Tom Cruise, low on the list because they have him rigged up and they're painting out all the cables.
Do we need to look at it through that lens though difficult was it?
I mean, I will say this. I will say this.
But it's probably harder to. I mean, you're right that he's not going to be hurt, but in terms of like a stunt, right? A stunt isn't measured by how likely the person is to die.
No, but I will say this. By the time we get into 4 and onward, it starts to feel more and more like Tom Cruise is trying to prove something to himself or trying to settle something, and the movies get dragged along, and I love the ride to get dragged along on it, but it definitely also feels like, Tom, you just wanted to do a Halo jump, huh?
Yeah, because he really did that. That was a real jump.
Yeah. Well, I think what's weird about...
And shout out to the guy holding the IMAX camera who also did the jump, but with a camera in his hand.
Really?
To me, there's an interesting thing in 6, which again, there's a lot of incredible sequences in 6, but I definitely found that like if they didn't tell me ahead of time about how incredible the stunts were, I don't think they would have. For example, the Halo jump, because they do like the lightning storm, mm-hmm. and just because you've seen so many from like Kingsman and other sort of sequences,
you assume it's like, going to be fake.
Yeah, it's just like when you watch it, it didn't feel that impressive to me, especially once they do the lightning storm thing. Cause I'm like, oh, it's CG. And even like the helicopter fight, they didn't tell me ahead of time. Like the moment where he falls onto the package is amazing, but the rest of it, I'm just like, okay, like these are, this is Star Wars.
They really went out of their way to be like, hey, Tom Cruise had to learn how to fly a helicopter. He's flying a helicopter in this one. And it's one of those ones where it's tough because I think the assumption that a lot of people have when you go into it is movies have this sort of meta narrative that they need to deal with now, which is mm-hmm. the assumption of, oh, this is all fake. And so they have to fight it in this weird way that, in a way, these time capsule movies of like 1 and 2, you're like, no, there's no way they're, you look at that movie, you're like, just the aesthetic of it, you're like, there's no way they're faking him doing this stuff. Like that's him for real, for sure. It has a different level of feel, I think.
Freddie, do you know how they did the helmetless motorcycle in 5?
So I believe the helmetless motorcycle was a mix of head replacement and there are sequences where I think it is just him. He learned the line, like they're doing a racing line, and Tom Cruise is a world-class race car driver / motorcycle operator. The story goes they were doing some movie, and like I think it was like the Ferrari.
Days of Thunder,
and it was like an F1 team was doing practice laps, and he was like, oh, let me get on the F1 car. And they're like, yeah, sure, Tom Cruise, go ahead. Get in the F1 car. One of the hardest vehicles to drive in the world because the way those cars work is you have to be going fast in the corners for the downforce to give you grip. And most human beings will chicken out. There's a great Top Gear episode where Richard Hammond tries it and he just cannot make it through a turn because it's so scary. And this is a guy who drives the car for a living. Tom Cruise clocked a lap in that F1 car so fast that they were like, if you quit and just train to be an F1 driver, you could be a world-class F1 driver today. Like he's that like tuned into motorsports and all that stuff. So he just learned the line and he just did it.
Look, I'm going to be honest. A lot of this is news to me. Like I did not know that he flew his own helicopter at the end. I just assumed like you said.
Yeah.
My assumption is artifice when I see anything on screen now.
Which is why to me, I mean, honestly, still the most, and this is also probably because I'm afraid of heights. Like, Four, when he goes, that shot of him coming out of the Burj Khalifa or whatever is still like the most, one of the most astonishing shots I've ever seen, like in a film. Like when he just, cause yes, he's tied up at that moment. The camera pivots around him as he goes off the edge and you're just with him over that overhang. I was just like jaw on the floor, that entire sequence.
Yeah.
Still my favorite stunt, which is I probably like 5. The airplane sequence in 5 is probably my close second, because also he's just like on the plane. Like it doesn't matter that he's strapped in. I'm just like, yeah, he's on the outside of a plane. This is crazy to watch.
Yeah. I mean, you go to a movie theater and you're like, Tom Cruise is going to do some crazy stuff. And you sit down and you're like, all right, and you get your popcorn and the movie starts. And within 3 minutes, you're like, oh, Tom Cruise is doing some crazy stuff.
Yeah.
There is a bunch of really, I mean, like, right, that kind of comes to this, it speaks to this old sort of Keaton-esque look at cinema, right? The idea of cinema as spectacle. And, you know, I think that, you know, I have a lot of thoughts, obviously, on the visual effects side of things, having come from a visual effects background, and how, you know, I think it's all, to some extent, a magic trick, you know, and nowadays people are much savvier to magic tricks and the sort of ways that these things are done. There is a sort of old school respect that you get, an old school thrill you get from watching these movies where you're like, oh, he's just really doing it. And
yeah,
it's tough. Yeah. I don't know. This one's tough for me because I think that there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of points into me for just from the Burj Khalifa sequence alone. And I think, but also at the same time, but at the same time, 5 has some of the more, to me, some of the more artfully done sequences. I don't know.
Well, I think that the Vienna opera fight. Is the Vienna opera fight to me, I think, is the, of all the fight scenes in the series, I think is the prettiest, most fun, most complex, interesting. And I love the location fight scene.
Yeah. If you said best action, I think 5 is my favorite action because both the fight and the motorcycle race, those two action sequences.
I wrote stunts on this category, but what I meant was, I was kind of combining stunts and action sequences. This is action. Mm. So think of this category as action.
Then I would give it to 5 in that case. Like 4, yeah. Like, cause Dubai is my favorite sequence, but like that's as much like thrill and spy stuff. Like 5, the motorcycle chase and the Vienna Opera House fight are probably my favorite action sequences, you know, along with like the bathroom brawl. And well, I mean, let's be honest. Again, literally the last 50 minutes of MI2 is nothing but John Woo masterclass action. But, you know, again, we'll just accept that it's not really Mission Impossible. It feels different. So we'll go.
We're picking the second best movie.
Yeah. We're picking the second best movie.
So does that mean we're going, are we all okay with Rogue Nation? I think that makes sense. I mean, you can get good stuff out of each of them, but
yeah, they all have great moments.
I think that makes sense as a winner. I have a bonus. So that's all of our categories. And before I tally it up, I do have like a little bonus category just going from memory. We don't have to go through a list for this.
Mm-hmm.
A hallmark of Mission Impossible is him receiving his mission instructions.
Yes.
It's done differently in every film, sometimes multiple times. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite? I in my mind immediately have an absolute favorite. The best moment for me is the old payphone that doesn't blow up right away.
That is, it's such a fun bit.
Wait, compared to rock climbing and a rocket goes to his foot and he's got Ray-Bans and then Limp Bizkit starts playing after his Ray-Bans blows up?
I don't want Limp Bizkit playing.
It wouldn't be a vacation as he throws his sunglasses with built-in headphones. I didn't even realize that you could have sunglasses with built-in headphones at the screen. Well, it's not even expecting at the screen. Towards me, as it explodes into the title sequence of a bomb going off, this is too by a long shot. There's no way you can do this. Three, he sits there with a portable camera and just blows away into dust.
Like, that idea?
Yeah.
That's it. Are you kidding me?
The idea?
He was wearing this on his head.
The idea that in order to give him a mission, they blatantly fly a helicopter that everybody can see, shoot a missile at him.
Right. And then the whole point is the discretion.
And then open it up to reveal sunglasses that he then wears. It's so good. It's like 10 layers. I'm like, what is going on?
It is. That might have to win. I will say I love in 5.
4 is really good. The payphone. Yes.
I love in 4 is the payphone and 4 is great. I love with the introduction of the syndicate, that Ethan is getting his message and that's when they flip it on him and they say, and we know this because we are the syndicate.
Oh, in Rogue Nation. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the record store. I like that one.
In the record store.
Record store is a cool moment.
See, because all of this stuff, though, the problem is at a certain point, it's making a riff on the thing that's already established. You have to establish it first. And the idea, again, of throwing sunglasses.
You sold me. That is the fact that it takes a helicopter, a rocket.
The dude who works with the IMF, you're in your suit and tie, right? And they're like, hey, we figured out where Ethan is. He's in the outback. You need to deliver a mission to him. It's like,
Cool. Got a piece of paper or a letter?
No. Don't change. The helicopter is spinning up right now. Just grab the rocket launcher we used to deliver the Ray-Bans with the message in them and just shoot it at his feet. Figure out where he is and shoot it at his feet. And the guy's like, all right. Hi, honey. How was your day at work? Well, on the outback, I guess. I got flown in. Ridiculous.
Oh, so good. It's so good.
Yeah, that one's pretty amazing.
That could win the bonus category. I would conclude the scorekeeping round. I've already tallied these.
It's pretty clear who the winner is.
It is not even close. The only movie before the bonus category that got more than one category win was Rogue Nation. And Mission Impossible 2, you'll be happy to hear, eked out thanks to the bonus category. 2 wins with 4 total category wins.
So coming in second.
Yeah. Coming second is MI2.
It's weird. It's weird. Oh, yeah. No, go ahead.
People of the world, you asked us a long time ago to pick the best Mission Impossible movie, and it took our new best friends, Freddie and Matt.
Oh, thank you.
To help us actually tackle this. But we use science. You cannot dispute science, people. And the scores tell us that the best movie is 2011's Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, directed by Brad Bird, with music by Michael Giacchino, with an invisibility screen, a 3D printer, which is, I mean, blow my mind.
Incredible tech.
and the introduction of Jeremy Renner, who conveniently disappears for the sixth movie. Will he be back? Probably not. But there you go. Asked and answered. It is Ghost Protocol.
I think you've given me the evidence, but it's kind of like telling somebody who believes Elvis is still alive that Elvis is dead. I'm like, I know in my head it's MI4, but in my heart,
it's two.
In your heart, it's two.
Two, because in no other one does he wear a leather coat so well. In no other one is he running and pulling off a face mask so well. In no other one does he have two guns, one in each hand, diving through as birds fly away from him on a motorcycle. Like, this is not even a question. The heart says two. The mind, I admit, says four.
What is the purpose of science if it gives us only wrong answers?
If only we had added a category for most dubs. That's what we were really missing.
I'm very happy with MI4. What a wonderful film. The whole series, man.
Yeah, it's really like worth watching them all over the course of a few days. Like it holds up. They all hold up. None of them have gotten worse since they first gave out, which is a credit to all of them. I love looking at a cell phone where they're like on an iPhone 4, I think.
Even as recently as Rogue Nation.
Protocol.
Yeah.
And then like what a web page looks like in Mission Impossible 1 and 2. Like
they're the Jules Verne's of the internet.
It became quaint instead of outdated. That's how it feels to me. It feels
that's
quaint.
That's a tough one to pull off.
Yeah.
Our movies don't survive that.
But fellas, thanks for doing this with us.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Freddie Wong and Matt Arnold, tell us about your podcast. What do you want to pitch?
Yeah. So we got two podcasts, one on the Maximum Fun Network and the one you should definitely check out. I mean, check out all of them if you want.
Yes.
But number one, Story Break. So this is a podcast where Matt, myself, and our writer friend, Will Campos, who we've worked with for years, we come up with a movie pitch off of a ridiculous idea, and we have an hour to do it. Past episodes include the Jar Jar Binks, in the entire Jar Jar Binks, like Star Wars Solo movie, but instead of Solo, it's Jar Jar Binks. I think we get a tearjerker out of that one.
Yep, that's a good movie.
Flow from progressive movie. We do a movie about why the chicken crossed the road. Like, just that joke as a full indie film. What were some of your favorites, Matt?
You named my favorites, especially, yeah. I wasn't expecting you to throw it to me. You do all the pitches. So, yeah, those ones, the ones that Freddie said, do those.
So
yeah,
great.
So check it out. That one's a very fun one. We just did Mambo Number 5 to kick off our third season here, which is fun, like rom-com. And by the way, don't worry. You don't need to see Mambo's 1 through 4 to get Mambo's. And we also do another podcast. It's a Dungeons & Dragons podcast called Dungeons & Daddies. It's not a BDSM podcast. I need to make that clear right at the very front in case you were confused. It's a Dungeons & Dragons podcast where we play with our friend Anthony Birch, writer of Borderlands 2 and the video games, and our friend Beth May, Matt Will, and myself. It's about four dads from our world who get thrown into the world of fantasy and Dungeons and Dragons, like in a quest to rescue their lost sons. The idea is that it's like regular suburban dads in the Lord of the Rings sort of fantasy world. And how do they cope with that? It's very fun. We get to channel our inner dad, Matt, being
I love
dad,
that.
Real dad. That's a lot of fun too. Dungeons and Daddies and Story Break.
Very cool. Go. Well, thank you for being here. This topic is closed. Thank you again to Kristen Kelly for another amazing topic. She's a big part of this team. This topic is closed, but there are many more to discuss. So please reach out to us on Twitter. Check out the Maximum Fun subreddit, or
you can email us at wegotthispodcast@gmail.com or go to the Facebook group. Talk about your favorite Mission Impossible moments. I bet you there's a GIF about it. That is facebook.com/groups/wegotthispodcast. Thank you to producer Ken Plume, researcher Kate McManus, graphic designer Uri Kelman, and QA engineer Jen Alba.
And thanks, of course, to our musicians, Jonathan Dinerstein and Mike Furman, for our score and theme song, respectively. And thanks to you, the people of the world, for giving us a chance not only to sit down and talk about these movies, but for giving us an excuse to sit down and watch the most expensive 6-episode series ever made. This was a lot of fun. Fellas, this was really fun. So thanks for...
Thank you for having us. It was a blast.
Please come
to
back.
The people of the world, thank you, thank you, thank you. For Hal Lublin, I'm Mark Gagliardi.
For Mark Gagliardi, I'm Hal Lublin. And don't worry, everybody.
We got this.
We got this.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.